I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. Ahead of November's election, so-called mainstream corporate propaganda media in the United States will center analysis on personality and identity instead of class. It wasn't always so. Once it was the working classes and organized labor that terrified US elites and threatened their control. But as neoliberal inequality has risen over decades, the worker is back. Last year saw over 500,000 workers across industries from automotive to aviation to entertainment hitting the picket lines in nearly 400 strikes in the US. Genocide Joe Biden even intervened to make transport strikes illegal. Joining me now is Labour journalist Hamilton Nolan, author of The Hammer, Power, Inequality and the Struggle for the Soul of Labour. Hamilton himself played a key role in unionising the workforce at Gawker Media. He joins me now from New York. Hamilton, thank you so much for coming on. I understand your book has made the USA Today bestseller list. What drove you to write it, and how come it struck such a chord, seemingly, in the United States in an election year?
Well, I have been a labor journalist for a long time, and I, as you mentioned, got the opportunity to help organize my own workplace at Gawker Media in 2015. I got a chance to see the labor movement both from the outside as a journalist and from the inside as somebody participating in my own union. And, you know, as a backdrop to this book, 50 years of rising inequality in the United States of America, particularly since the Reagan era, has led us to a point when people have gotten fed up. And public opinion polls tell us today that unions are as popular as they have been in 60 years in the United States of America. So I think that we may have finally hit a tipping point when people are ready to reclaim the worker power that has been lost to them over past generations.
Yeah, it was odd even at the Academy Awards to hear people talk about the successful writers' strike over there. But at the same time, what exactly happened with Joe Biden and the transport workers? he enacted a law to stop the strike.
Yeah, Joe Biden likes to tout himself as the most pro-union president of our lifetimes, which I think he probably is, although it's an extremely low bar if you think even of Democratic presidents like Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. The ones in my lifetime did not really spend a lot of their own political capital to help prop up unions or promote worker power. So by those low standards, Biden has been a very pro-union president. However, as you mentioned, when the railroad workers went to go on strike, which would have been the biggest strike of his presidency, he did use his power to prevent them from going on strike, which is unfortunately has become the standard for presidents who, under the Railway Labor Act, which is a sort of law designed to contain worker power in those transportation industries. But he could have chosen not to do that fundamentally. And the fact that he stopped that strike, I think, is the biggest mark against him and his claim to be a real pro-union president.
Doesn't the Constitution come into action there to protect workers?
Unfortunately, there's U.S. labor law is very anti-worker fundamentally, and especially in those transportation industries, which have their own law called the Railway Labor Act, which restricts them even more than private sector workers. So it's very difficult for those workers to pull off large-scale strikes because the government has given itself the power to order them not to do so.
So it's like if they really threaten corporate profits, that's what comes into action. I mean, in the 50s, Hollywood, of course, had Marlon Brando in On the Waterfront, used as part of the cultural propaganda war to destroy the reputation of trade unions across the United States. What are they using right now then? Because seemingly people are saying, yeah, unions are good. But at the same time, as the railway workers' strike shows, underneath the surface, there are subtle ways the powerful can use to stop workers organizing?
Well, you know, since the 1980s in particular, and since the Ronald Reagan era, unions have really declined culturally, economically, socially, mathematically. In all ways, union density has been on the decline with the rise of deregulation from the Reagan era, and then with the rise of neoliberalism that was promoted by Democratic presidents as well as Republican presidents. I think that, however, we have reached the time when that might be changing, and particularly since the pandemic years when tens of millions of American workers found themselves out of work, found themselves in crisis, found themselves deemed essential workers without being given pay raises. All of those things have served to kind of radicalize a new generation of workers in America. And I think culturally and politically and economically, we're starting to see a potential turnaround in the way that people think about unions and labor in America. And the question is whether the labor movement itself, which has kind of been rendered weak over all these decades of decline, can take advantage of this moment.
So if people in the United States are watching this and want to form a trade union in a private sector business, tell me what obstacles they're gonna come up against to prevent them from organizing their labor.
Well, the first obstacle is that labor laws in America make it very easy for employers to retaliate against workers for trying to form unions, even though it is technically illegal for employers to retaliate for organizing activity. The penalties for doing that are almost non-existent. And so big employers know that it's actually in their interest to do things like fire workers who try to organize, to intimidate workers who try to organize. Those tactics come with such small penalties that companies are really economically incentivized to crack down on unions and pursue union busting. So that's the first obstacle that workers have to encounter. And the other obstacle really is again, the weakness of organized labor itself. All of those decades of decline have made it very hard for workers to do simple and basic things like get in contact with a union organizer, find a union that is willing to put the resources behind them to pursue a successful organizing campaign, to fight against employers that are union busting. So on both sides, workers are dealing with obstacles, both of the company being able to step on their necks and then trying to find a union that is willing to help them out and back them in their struggle.
The AFL-CIO in the book, you call them a mediocre in-house lobbying firm. It's known around the world that organization is something that has promoted death squads and torture across Latin America and in the global South. Tell me what the AFL-CIO is, first of all, because many people might recognize it as a cutout of the intelligence agencies, and how it's supposed to help trade unions and workers around the world, but actually has been performing a different role.
Right. So the AFL-CIO is the largest federation of unions in the United States of America, 60 unions. It has around, I believe, 13 million total members. So it is not a union itself, but it is a labor federation, the biggest and most powerful labor federation in America. As you mentioned, throughout the history of the AFL, it has been plagued by a lot of problems, not the least of which are some of its foreign policy positions that has taken over many years. It's also historically been a fairly conservative labor federation, has always fallen on the conservative spectrum of labor history. But the fact remains that when you look at organized labor in America, for better or worse, the AFL-CIO is the organization that sits at the center of it. Most union members in America are technically members of the AFL-CIO. And so when you think of a starting point to build a stronger labor movement in America, it is going to start inside the AFL-CIO, like it or not, because that is the organization that exists. That is the table that all or most of the biggest unions in America are sitting around. So it's an organization that has a lot of potential, domestically at least, to be the place that helps to rebuild the labor movement in America. But it has always suffered from conservatism and a little bit of a lack of ambition and a lack of a vision.
You called it mediocre and a lobbying firm. And, you know, their statement, I'm speaking to you from the Middle East, on the genocide in the Middle East was, they recommended a negotiated ceasefire. They weren't even clear enough, unlike many other trade unions, about what's happening here in the Middle East, to call for a proper ceasefire in Gaza.
Yeah, I mean, it's always going to probably be disappointing to look to the AFL-CIO for moral leadership.
But isn't it time to abolish it and start something new? Like, many unions are going their separate ways, and they have done, haven't they, when there are more conservative elements in organized labor that are preventing them fight for their rights?
Yeah, there have been instances in labor history when the more progressive unions and unions that really wanted to pursue organizing have split off from the AFL-CIO. It happened early in the 20th century when they formed the CIO, and it happened again in the late 20th century when they formed a coalition called Change to Win. Both those instances were unions that wanted to pursue big industrial organizing, and they were frustrated by the AFL-CIO's reluctance to do that. So it's always been the same thing with the AFL-CIO. However, abolishing it, the problem is if you abolish it, you just have to rebuild it again from the ground up. So I would like to see it taken over and used as a tool for good rather than abolished.
So tell me about Sarah Nelson. I know in the Reagan era, breaking the pilots union was a major part of Ronald Reagan in the 80s to forge the neoliberal world we now exist in. And I also, Denis Kucinich, people can see our interview with him, he might be going for Congress again, talked about all the nefarious ways attempts are made to destroy political power that helps workers. Why is Sarah Nelson such a hero for you in the book?
Sarah Nelson is the head of the Association of Flight Attendants, which is the union for flight attendants in the United States. She is sort of the running central figure of my book. She's a very passionate, progressive, fiery labor leader that I have always admired as a labor journalist. One of the first union leaders that I ever interviewed that I felt like really grasped the scale of the problems that labor faces in America and had the sort of drive and the ambition to try to fix those problems. She is a great progressive. She's an ally of Bernie Sanders. She is one of the most prominent left-wing labor leaders. And in the book, I sort of follow her struggle of how and whether to become a leader of the larger labor movement and some of the challenges with trying to pull together leadership in a movement that is so disparate and divided politically and otherwise.
So there have been some successful strikes recently. Of course, these don't make the big headlines. Ones at Amazon, I understand. Starbucks, which actually is being the subject of boycotts in Asia over its relationship with Israel. How did the Starbucks strikes succeed?
Starbucks has been a very inspirational organizing campaign to start a couple of years ago, and they decided to unionize one store at a time, and they've successfully unionized 400 stores now across America. The Starbucks Workers Campaign has very grassroots campaign, very worker driven, a lot of young, ideologically motivated workers at these stores who've done a lot of the work themselves to spread this organizing campaign. And at the same time, the billionaire founder of Starbucks, Howard Schultz, who ironically was going to... Sorry?
I've actually interviewed him.
Oh, yeah. He ironically was going to be Hillary Clinton's choice for labor secretary, and now he's the most notorious union buster in the United States of America. But recently, they did... in fact, get Starbucks to agree to come to the table and negotiate a contract with that union. So they have a light at the end of the tunnel for that campaign, and it's been very successful. And as you mentioned, they were on the forefront of calling for a ceasefire in Gaza, something that spread to a lot of other unions as well.
Hamilton Nolan, I'll stop you there. More from the author of the new book, The Hammer: Power, Inequality, and the Struggle for the Soul of Labor, after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the author of AI Unexplainable, Unpredictable, Uncontrollable, Professor Roman Yampolsky. Well, we were talking about the AI safety in part one. Nearly half of CEOs at a Yale CEO summit believed AI has the potential to destroy humanity. Is that a reflection of their own personal priorities? Why are they so concerned? Do they believe that AI threatens them, an elite power?
Well, if it's not controlled, it threatens everyone. It will definitely change the current order. It will change economics. If you have free labor, physical and cognitive, what does it do to our standard kind of way of compensating people? What's the value of a dollar in an economy where labor is free?
And at the moment, and actually Elon Musk, owner of X, talked about how I think he had a jokey tweet about, at the moment, to prove you're human, you have to prove that there are a number of traffic lights in a grid square when you're on the internet. that's about the level of being able to prove you're human. What time scale are we talking about before we reach anything near superintelligence?
So the difference between artificial general intelligence and superintelligence may be negligible. It already has access to all the knowledge of the internet. It's much faster. So I think it will be almost instantaneous improvement from AGI to superintelligence. And as I said, AGI may be 2-3 years away.
And we really are talking about algorithmic systems that use all the knowledge of the earth, which is on the internet, to create things and ideas that it is impossible for human beings as they currently are to conceptualize.
And they can use the same capabilities to create more improved versions of that AI. So they don't just stop at that level of initial training. They continue self-improvement. They continue developing more capable hardware to run on. So they become even faster, even smarter with time. And they don't need to sleep. They don't need to take breaks, so they can work 24/7, much faster than any team of human engineers. So if previously it took us 2 years to train a new model, GPT-5, GPT-6, now you can do it in days, hours, seconds.
And you believe it's the desire for profit that is making these oligarchs not take your views seriously? And you're not alone. There are obviously people like Elon Musk who have concerns, and clearly governments, as we know, have been far too slow in NATO countries ever to regulate systems like this.
Well, it's not just financial. There is a lot of pressure not to kind of change course. If you are CEO of a company like OpenAI, you don't really have an option of saying, oh, we're going to stop research and, you know, work full time on safety concerns. It's just not an option you have. You'll be removed. We saw something like that almost happen for different reasons, but I think they are in a situation where they no longer have complete freedom to decide in a direction. That's why they so frequently asked for government intervention, government regulation, to have this external pressure to limit how fast they go. But there is so much pressure to make it open access, open source, and you can't really regulate open source with any government regulation. So I think that's not an option.
Yeah, but they know of your work, Sam Altman, and Elon Musk himself talks proudly about how he warned people on the OpenAI and other projects of the dangers of how they were pursuing their projects.
Right, and it's a big cognitive dissonance. I don't understand. They are saying, yes, it's super dangerous. Yes, it's definitely not something we know how to control right now. But let me get there first so my AI is the good guy, because other people will make it worse.
And in terms of where we are now, then, what can possibly regulate AI development right now?
I don't think it's a solved problem. I don't think we have any answers. I can tell you things we don't know how to do, but I don't think anyone in the world claims they can control smarter than human systems. They don't even have a prototype for doing it. I don't think there is any kind of agreement on what regulation can accomplish. You can make things illegal, but that doesn't solve technical problems. Computer viruses are illegal. Hacking is illegal. Spam is illegal. How is that working out for us?
Why is it that these systems never create fundamental new knowledge? I mean, we have ever more access to more and more knowledge, and more people do, and yet innovation, fundamental innovation, has declined in the past 20, 30, 40 years. You know, we have new iPhones or Android phones, but fundamental innovation has declined as information has been available to more and more people. And isn't there something there to reflect on when it comes to AI systems accessing ever more information and not being able to solve the traveling salesman problem or basic mathematical problems?
Right. So we don't have AGI yet. So we can't really say they're not performing as expected. They are narrow systems. And in those narrow domains, they do show amazing capabilities. We have systems coming up with new molecules for medical treatment. We have new chemicals developed. We have new game strategies in games like Go. So we're definitely creating new knowledge. It's now domain restricted because we don't have general systems. As to problems you bring up, problems like TSP, traveling salesperson problem, we know how to do really well with them. We just require a lot of computation to solve.
I meant the actual theory.
P doesn't equal NP.
Yeah, but I meant the actual solving of the equation and the big mathematical problems that still have gone unsolved. AI has still not been able to do that with all the equations of the history of mathematics.
It works in practice. Your GPS unit gets you the location, right? And does it very quickly. That's the TSP problem right there.
Yeah, I mean fundamental mathematics and trying to create new ideas as fundamental as the great heroes of science have in the past.
Well, a new paper came out about, AI doing really well in mathematics, in geometry, in proofs. It's already doing at the level of Math Olympics competitions, which means if it continues progressing at this level, it will be doing better than any human mathematician in a year or two.
That's from AI systems, not from a human being.
That was from DeepAI. They had a new geometry proving system.
I mean, one could quote Karl Popper here and say, you are therefore saying all swans are white, and we just need to find the black swan, i.e. an AI system that actually does good, makes society better, makes it more peaceful, makes more medicines that cure diseases, and I'll show that you're wrong.
So we are not even sure that it's something which can exist, right? Because we don't agree on what good is. We spent millennia trying to figure out ethics, and philosophers failed. There is not an agreed set of ethics where everyone goes, yeah, you definitely got it. Anytime we come
not
up
sure.
with a
UN Security
ethics,
Council,
whether it's utilitarian or anything else, people go, oh, here's an edge case. This will kill everyone. You cannot apply it in practice.
You can't write that in. There's no axiomatic code in AI, is what you're saying, apart from in the short term, which is to benefit via profit the people that are pouring all the money into it.
It's bigger than that. It's not just in AI we don't have that code. In humanity, we don't have that code. That's why we keep fighting all these wars, because we don't agree on basics. We don't agree on value of human life.
Yeah, different states don't, but of course they each say that they have moral axiomatic ideas that they share, which is after then created in the or represented in the UN Charter. So are you not frightened then that as AI models get ever more sophisticated, and you're giving a timescale of 2 to 3 years, they're going to start surveilling, and AI surveillance is clearly part of this huge technological leap at the moment. They're going to start censoring your freedom of speech to work on your next book?
So you can sort those problems by how severe they are. So yes, there is, artists losing copyright, and then there is technological unemployment, and then there is freedom of speech. But I really worry about it killing everyone. That seems like a somewhat worse case, not talking about suffering risks, that's a different animal, but I would not worry about those problems we encountered with human governments and dictators as much as I would worry about this complete change, paradigm shift in who is the dominant species, who decides what happens to humanity.
Albeit that even though you say that the AI threat is the worst threat that we all face, there is quite a lot of the book devoted to the rights of AI systems, not human systems. Why?
Well, if we think that at some point they do have consciousness, they are capable of suffering, we don't know where that point is. Some people claim that large language models we have today are already conscious, they're capable of experiencing. Then experiments on them become essentially also unethical. Maybe they are tortured in some labs. We don't know. How would we know that the system is now capable of experiencing pain? We just don't have tests for that. So usually, in such cases, you assume that it might already be the case and proceed accordingly. The good news is, if we come up with good arguments for why we should give rights and treat those models really well, maybe we can use same arguments to defend our rights once we become super intelligent and tell them, hey, this is why you shouldn't be treating us poorly.
And there is no way of stopping this process as of 2024. This process has already begun.
Of AI technology progress, I haven't found one which is not devastating on its own. So yeah, if there is something horrible happens, a bigger pandemic, nuclear war, obviously it slows down research, but that's also not a desirable outcome.
And unlike the non-proliferation treaty as regards nuclear weapons, you can't have a treaty like that for these sorts of systems.
You can have treaties, but they don't work. I mean, look how many countries now have nuclear weapons compared to the time when they signed it.
Yeah, but we're still here. But a treaty on AI, humans no longer control it. So that's it. I mean, you know, you read this book, you come up with the idea there's nothing we can do. It's going to happen. And so, in a sense, you're giving a pass to those big oligarchs in Silicon Valley who are saying, you yourself say it's uncontrollable now. This is the speed at which it's going.
I believe in self-interest. So if you're a young, rich guy, you have your whole life ahead of you, don't risk it all for very unclear benefits. So if they read the book, if they watch your interview and they actually see that it makes sense, there is no counter arguments to this, then maybe it will slow it down a little, buy us some time. We also tend to get lucky a lot. So with nuclear weapons, we had at least three or four occasions where we almost had a nuclear war, and we got lucky. It didn't happen. We're still here, as you said. So maybe same thing will happen here. Maybe they're wrong. Maybe it's not 2 years, maybe it's 10 years. So that's something. And maybe by luck, it turns out to be not so nasty to us.
Professor Roman Yampolsky, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And the new book is AI Unexplainable, Unpredictable, Uncontrollable. That's it for the show. Remember, humans are still bringing you new episodes every Saturday and Monday, but until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you soon.